You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
All right, in today's episode of the JRE Review, Joe is still away hunting, or at least I assume he is. He posted some things to Instagram where I guess he left his truck at LAX while he was away, and a bunch of cats shit all over the roof of his truck, which was hilarious, and he posted a video of that. So at least also, he is back.
That's also apparently a really good place to leave a dead body in the trunk of a car at an airport. I read that in a Jack Reacher novel, but I was like, you know what? That makes sense. Sometimes you just hear something and you're like, of course, that makes perfect sense. Like, usually it's religion, but sometimes it's, getting rid of a dead body. It's not a big deal.
That's it. I always think that when I'm in the parking lots of airports, that, like, how many of the cars here either have a dead body in the back or a load of cocaine?
100%. Like
there's a ton of shady shit that goes on. People land, they drop stuff off. It's got to be like that.
Absolutely. Because if the people who work in the parking lots, if their work ethic is anything like the people who work inside the airport, there might be cars there from the 70s.
It's so true.
My girlfriend always gets on me because we'll like park at a drugstore parking lot and then walk to this bar. And she's like, aren't you worried that something might happen to the car? I'm like, I can't even get these fuckers to like get me some hydrocortisone cream in less than an hour. You think they're going to go to the trouble of having a car towed? I think not.
No, they don't even go outside. I think they live in the store.
Hell yeah, they live in the store.
It's like CVS trolls. But yeah, so Joe is back. He's doing something. He is back. Still no podcast though. So today we're going to have a conversation, Mark and I. And Mark's going to be showing up on this podcast a lot more moving forward.
Woohoo!
And we're going to talk a little bit about hunting. We're going to talk a little bit about some mix-ups in comedy at the moment. And some things I know about really what got Joe into hunting. So without further ado, let's start this review. Right. I really have to stop saying without further ado, let's start this review. I forget that it rhymes and it's so stupid every time I say it.
All of a sudden that's just your tagline.
And now, I'm stuck with it. I apologize to anyone listening. If you're like, that's dumb. Yes, I agree as well. And I will try to remember to
it is dumb,
not
but
do it in this way. Yeah.
Here we are. Yeah.
Here we are, making it through. Making it through. Now, Mark, what is your background with hunting? Have you ever done any? Do you know? Tell me. Fill me
so,
in.
Okay, so I grew
never
up
in, asked you this.
Yeah, no, I grew up in the southeastern United States. So I grew up in Atlanta, did a little time in Tennessee for high school, went to college in Alabama. I actually lived for like 6 months in Alabama before high school. So we moved around a little bit. We were southern nomads. And obviously, hunting is incredibly popular in the southeastern United States. However, I was raised by a mom who, even though she was from South Carolina, was more of a Yankee than most Yankees that live in the northeastern United States. Complete and utter, like, snob about everything. And so she was not, she had a, huge influence on my life, obviously. And so she was not for hunting. She was a big animal rights activist. So I wasn't really for hunting either. It just kind of seemed like something other people did, not me. However,
sure,
as any kid growing up that liked movies, and I was one of them, I had a fascination with guns because, action heroes had guns and stuff. And I got a pellet gun. I don't know. My dad bought it for me, much to my mom's chagrin. And so I got a pellet gun. And this was when I was in Alabama as a kid. And I had a buddy who lived down the street. Couldn't tell you his name if my life depended on it. But we went over to his house, and it was a rifle. I had a rifle, and it had a scope on it. So automatically, I was the coolest dude in the world because I was like a sniper. And we thought it would be really cool to try it out. And so, and I guess, I was 12, maybe not. I don't even think I turned 13. And there was a bird in his tree. And we decided that we would use it for target practice. And I'm sorry I'm laughing because this is actually really fucking horrible. We shot the bird. I shot the bird. The scope was pretty good. It was a pretty good shot, actually. Hit the bird.
Nice.
Felt horrible about it. I mean, devastated. Absolutely devastated that I just taken the life of this innocent creature who was doing fuck all to anyone. He was just singing in a tree. I mean, I can...
Yeah, a bit unnecessarily cruel there, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, but I'm just like, if I were just singing in my bathroom and somebody came in and just shot me, I'd be like, the fuck? I wasn't doing anything. I was minding my own fucking business. You popped a cap in my ass. But here's the best part. I went on like a field trip like a month or two later to some nature reserve, and they were showing us endangered animals that were indigenous to Alabama. And lo and behold...
Oh, shit.
The bird I shot was one of them.
Oh, no.
So at that point, I went from just being like feeling really guilty to being like the war criminal. So so that's my hunting story. Oh, and I've shot a gun since then at like a gun range once. But I've not shot an animal or anything. I did hit a squirrel once, but that was his fault. He thought he would play linebacker to my 1994 Honda Accord. And even though that car was a piece of shit, it won. It won. It didn't tackle him.
Roadkill doesn't count.
Yeah, exactly. So
roadkill doesn't count. No, I think you hit something on the head there. I mean, there is that childhood fascination with guns. Yeah. You know, you see action movies, you see guns. I remember that. Like, I grew up in England with a vegetarian family, and my dad was a pacifist. So playing with guns and even the idea of that and hunting was not on the table at all. It was talked about in a very negative light. And that's the thing.
Sure.
There's pro hunters, and then there's people that are anti-hunters. There's very rarely people kind of shrugging their shoulders in the middle. It's just
it's true. A
topic where people are passionate, you know, and this is where that misunderstanding kind of comes from. So, but in a lot of ways, you find that there's passion and love for animals on both ends of it. And that was something cool that I learned about hunting as I got kind of more into it. But yeah, there's that childhood kid fascination, and then shoot a bird. Of course, you got a gun, you're gonna shoot at a bird or something, or a squirrel, and yeah, you'll probably feel bad about it, you're gonna have emotions about it, you know, you're understanding life and death and all the rest of it, and it's kind of, you know, you go one way or another, but there is something that draws us to it. It's in our DNA. To hunt is in our DNA. It has to be.
Well, I mean,
we got this far.
We descend from hunter-gatherers, and for all but 2% of human existence, hunting was...
Of course.
That was the way you got food. So, yeah. I mean, we're omnivores. I don't care what anyone says. Look at our teeth. We have the teeth of omnivores. We have the digestive enzymes of omnivores. We're meant to digest both plants and, you know, meat, protein like that. That's a part of things. Unless you're just
eating oysters, you got to hunt the meat.
You do. I mean, it even just comes to fishing. Like, you got, I mean, you know, Tom Hanks in Castaway. Like, he might have been a vegetarian, but then he got fucking hungry. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah,
you gotta eat a lot of coconuts to stay alive.
So as far as hunting goes, I don't love it, but I kind of understand that there are times when it's a necessary evil.
That's kind of the point with really, you know, a lot of hunters today, and especially Joe. Like, for example, Joe Rogan, his t- turn on to hunting was about, I think it was like 2012 was the first time he went hunting.
Yeah.
And he went I think rifle for deer, if I believe it, because I remember him talking about it on the podcast. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, he's fallen in love with it. Now, he went with a guy called Steve Ranella. He's a very mm-hmm. well-known hunter who produced the show Meat Eater, which is a really well-done show. The narration in that show, it's almost like Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknown cooking show. It's like uh-huh. not just about cooking, but it's like interesting philosophy. Steve Ranella does that very well in his own way, but with the show Meat Eater. And on it was another guy called Dan Doty.
Mm-hmm.
And Dan Doty has been on Joe's podcast a couple of times and has this men's group organization called Everyman, right? And mm-hmm. that was the men's group organization that I was a part of. After right. hearing him on Rogan, I knew that Dan Doty was very good friends with an old friend of mine from high school many, many, many years ago. And they lived in Montana.
Pardon me.
I flew out, Gesundheit, to meet them and yeah. like chat with Dan and see what this men's group stuff was about. I don't know. I was so weary of it. I was so like, what the fuck is this? Is this like a cult thing? But, you know, my friend was all in and loved it. And I respected him a lot. And after I got to understand it, I'm like, okay, cool. I see also why Joe really likes this guy. He's real honest and like, you know, just he's a man, you know, he hunts, but he's also like connected to his feelings and has these groups, and he's a fascinating guy, really. But right. it was cool because I get to talk to him firsthand about what it was like for like taking Joe hunting for the very first time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a pretty cool story.
Cool.
It's cool to hear anytime somebody first gets into it. But what's good about Joe doing it is that he's such an advocate for things that he loves.
Yeah.
Right? Like anyone, you know, I get passionate about things I like, so do you. And when he gets to understand something, he's coming at it from an adult mindset. I mean, I think he must have been in his 40s. When he first went.
Yeah.
So he's had a whole life without hunting, and now he sees this new thing. And he was up against the wall. He decided that he didn't want to do the factory farming shit anymore. He didn't like it.
Right.
He didn't like the idea of all the food coming from there. So he's either going to be a vegetarian or he was going to start hunting his own meat. And I think that's a cool...
That I really respect. I really do. That's really yeah. putting your money where your mouth is. In terms of
and it wasn't about, oh, I want to shoot animals, and I, like, he started right. with the idea of like, okay, but now I have to see what it's like to go get this meat yourself, and will sure. I even enjoy it? And
yeah.
of course he chooses the hardest discipline eventually, which is the bow hunting. And I've uh-huh. been bow hunting since I think I was like 17, so that's
no
20
shit.
years.
Really? Yeah.
Well, we had him in New Mexico when I went to high school there. We all used to bow hunt.
Oh, I had no idea.
Friends,
I had no idea yeah. about that. That's really cool. I'm gonna start calling you
it's
Legolas.
So fun, right? it's so fun. Shooting a bow is something else. Like, shooting guns is great.
Oh, yeah.
There's something about the intricacies and the fine tuning and everything of a bow. Bow is much harder. It takes a lot longer to get good at it.
That and, I
it's
firmly
so
believe. Well, and you know, I think there's something to be said in terms of, you know, hunting for yourself, hunting for your own meat, for your family, as it were. Like if you're in the zombie apocalypse. Like, I've long come to terms with the fact that I have zero discernible skills that would aid me in the zombie apocalypse. I'm a writer and a comic, so I have zero skills. But, you know, knowing how to hunt and dress and things like that would come in really handy. But I will say, trophy hunting, I feel, is utterly despicable, and I want nothing to do with it. And I just don't see the point. I don't see the point in killing these beautiful creatures that you're not going to eat. You're going to take a picture with, put it on Facebook, or mount it on your wall. That I can't get behind. Just don't like it. That one's
squirrely.
It's just,
you know,
it's
really
barbarism
squirrely.
For barbarism's sake, and I can't stand it. I loathe it. When I see, you know, these tarted up idiots, some dentist in Minnesota, like holding up a, you know, a lion or a tiger, or you see the, you know, the horrible poaching of elephants, that which are such sweet creatures. I'm like, no, no. I mean, I'm not a vegetarian, and you know, chickens are, you know, for the most part, pretty stupid. And so I'm like, yeah, kill them, go. But some of these are really precious creatures, and I loathe that. I just absolutely loathe trophy hunting.
But let's say, for the sake of what it is, that we don't understand the full story of that, right? It's easy for us to see it on the outside and be like, yeah, that's fucked up. Why would you shoot that, you rich Westerners? Like,
pretty much.
All the things that you said, right?
Right.
But then you hear those stories of like, okay, so there's a big group of rhino in this area, and one of the older males that's no longer breeding is running around killing other males. So within that area, they usually will send in somebody to take the rhino out. Well, so they could do it for $0, or they could auction it off, and let's say they sell it for $50,000. A portion goes to some of the villages around. And this is all hypothetical. I don't know if it works like this, but I've heard similar stories when people try to just kind of like inform me of like, oh, sometimes it works like this in these areas. Then you get the habitation portion of it, where they're trying to bring back more endangered species, like some of these elephants and so on.
No, and that's but that's conservation, and I can get behind conservation
and use it. Yeah, I think there's a truth in there, and I just don't understand.
I think there is, and if we're so, let's operate under that hypothetical. Let's just assume that's right, and you know, for the sake of the conversation. And if it's not, then obviously everyone listening should know that this is these opinions are based entirely upon that hypothetical and not based on anything else. The world is not black and white. It's gray, and there are things that happen. And I loathe the idea that, you know, even though so let's say you have that rhino that's going crazy and killing other males, but he won't breed, and you have a population problem happening, and this is a solution, and then the choice is to make $50,000 off of it or zero, which would mean that it probably there might be some black market shit going on. Does that encourage more poaching? That's the question. But I also understand that $50,000 might go a long way towards those conservation efforts. So it's this weird double-edged sword hypothetical that may or may not be real. And I get it. Yeah. But
Just has to be – either way, I think it needs to be very carefully monitored. And it's hard to do. Now, in the U.S., agreed, they do a much better job. Like,
they do.
In the U.S., they do. The hunting that I've experienced – in multiple states is very well organized,
very well regulated too.
Yeah, you get tags. We actually, the U.S. has the most money, like within the billions a year for conservation, and no other country raises that. Now, here's a good example of something similar to what I was just saying about what happens in Africa. Other countries like England and European ones that are very conscious about the environment and recycling and all this can't raise anywhere near the money for animal conservation as the U.S. can, because the U.S. is making their money from the hunting tax and these licenses and all the rest of it to hunt just a few. So we actually have the best kept preserves in the U.S. I say we, I'm a citizen, so I'm allowed to.
Absolutely, you are.
But that's how it works, right? So the idea is sound. It's almost like, wow, when let's say PETA were like, let's ban all hunting forever. Cool.
Okay, of course.
That's your end game. Imagine if they did that, and then all of a sudden, conservation money drops 100 times or more, to where they're like, "Shit, we can't maintain any of these areas because of this money." It's almost like that's another example, almost of like, you know, it's kind of a catch-22 in a weird way, especially if you're anti-hunting.
Well, it's definitely a consideration, and there's always. You know, there's always more caveats to the story than what it is on its surface. But I would say, as a general rule, I'm against trophy hunting, but I understand hunting for conservation and for food.
Yeah. You know? Well, at least there's no real, like, they don't do trophy hunting in the U.S. Like, I don't believe they, at least in.
Well, there, I mean, there's some people, count, you know, The elk and, you know, the deer heads on the walls, and that's, I don't know, that's a little barbaric for me. That's just
that's trophy-ish stuff.
It is,
I think it's just because it's so difficult, though, especially if you get one with a bow. I mean, sure. I wouldn't say that I know, and I know plenty of people in New Mexico that have, you know, racks. I don't own any. I never kept any of mine.
Uh-huh.
And in some ways, it's like, to them, it would be more disrespectful. It's like I didn't care enough. Mostly, it's not that. I moved around a lot, and I didn't know how to carry a bunch of horns everywhere. But but I know hunters that will keep them all because it was like the story of that hunt.
And sure.
It's kind of like the honor of, like, they worked for it. You don't always get something when you go out there. It's very, very difficult.
Sure.
It's hard. It's not just like a bunch of fat guys smoking cigars, and then they're like, there's one, shoot it. It's just
exactly.
It's not.
It's heading straight
so
for us.
So much work in there. Yeah, it's heading straight for us. It's so there is like that bit of appreciation, but it comes across so ugly when you Instagram a picture of yourself smiling next to it.
Just
I totally
the worst.
Get it. Yeah, I totally,
totally
get it.
Totally.
Nobody's thinking about all the work that you put in, how long that was, how the shot was just you trained for like so long to get into the right position and be able to take it down, and this was your one, you know, kill for the year on that tag, and it just means the world to you, and you're going to keep all of the meat and give it to your family and friends, and it's going to be a big thing, you know, it's going to be a big deal. None of that passion comes across in that photo to people
True.
That don't do it, so I get it. It's a
right.
It's a tricky one.
The only thing that comes across is... Yeah, no, the only thing that comes across is the dead thing that they're holding.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, but I think, look, Joe does a really good job of describing this. When he talks about what hunting is to him and why he does it and why he believes in it and how the conservation stuff goes and he has these hunters on, I think it really has helped at least open people's eyes to the idea of these things and at least taken a little bit away from the idea that it's just this barbaric event. Like what's really barbaric is all the meat you ate this week. That's fucking way worse than anything hunters are doing. But we just don't think about
it. Well, no, it's true.
I guess
out of sight, out of mind.
Foods or whatever. Yeah.
It's
gross what goes on in those places. And that's the shit we don't talk about. It's almost like those places have the animal rights people and the hunters fighting with each other while they just stand to the side and go, nah, hilarious.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's the idea of fighting over table scraps while somebody feasts inside. It's like your problem isn't with the other person who wants, you know, fighting for the table scraps. Your problem is with the person inside the mansion that won't share their whole, you know, hall.
Yeah, I would say to anybody that... You don't have to hunt, but if you ever get the chance to just even go with some people doing it, you know, you'll be hiking, you'll be camping, there'll be like an experience with it. If you leave and you're truly disgusted, fine. You know, that's your choice, and that's excellent, because then I would say it's a very informed choice. Like, you got to see it up close, and you're like, no. But,
right.
But I would really recommend it, because I think that you would see it quite differently. You know, it'll be like anything. It's like going to a different country when you don't understand somebody's culture. Really
exactly.
Immersing yourself in some sort of celebration that they do that we think is kind of barbaric and messed up, and then you're like, oh shit, I understand where this is coming from now. I see what's happening, and you'll see these guys or gals, like a lot of women hunt too, you're like, wow, these people have a lot of respect for these animals. It's not just shoot them in the head. It's not any of that.
Totally. I mean, Native Americans, I remember this coming to my fifth grade class, and they were talking about how they paid such respect to the animal, and it was a huge thing, paying respect to these animals, you know, saying like a prayer over their body, thanking them for their sacrifice, and then using every damn part of the animal, because they were like, this is not something we want to do, but if we have to do it, obviously we go after either the one of the oldest ones or the one of the ones lagging behind, so the strong ones continue to reproduce, you know, they continue to be fit, and then they pay complete respect to that animal's sacrifice. And I think that's and that was obviously from a time when you hunted. Like, that was how it was. Like, you hunted or you die, you know, the hunter-gatherer time. So,
well, so much of it
and I think it's a wonderful tradition.
Usable too.
Absolutely.
It's all really wasted today. We just mostly eat muscle because it's like,
I know.
You know, easy to deal with. I mean, bones aren't really used. The cartilage stuff, you can boil all that down. Bone marrow is fucking delicious.
They used the brain because that was because morbid curiosity I had. I'm like, what do you use the brain for? And they actually used brain matter is almost like a primer on hide for painting. Like if they were going to do any art or illustration work or anything like that for their rituals, they used brain as like a primer. It was weirdest thing. Yeah, I'll never forget it in my entire life. They would put it on
Cool. That's like a cool fact that as a kid you just get given.
Yeah.
And you're like, I'm never going to forget this. This is sweet.
Exactly. Yeah, it was one of those cool things that I'll just always remember.
Well, it's almost like we're kind of going back to it. You see more organ meat now in stores. You mm-hmm. can buy bones again. And real nice restaurants are starting to serve like bone marrow. You know, they give you big things of bone. And you get some bread, and then, you know, you're like scooping out the marrow, and it's really good. It's
like a
super delicacy, and that shit that you just used to chuck. Well, it's so nutritious. I don't know why you got so lazy.
I guess it should be nutritious, huh?
Yeah, it's really, the muscle is, other than all the protein, which it has a lot of protein, which is very good. You want a lot of protein and some fat. It doesn't have a ton of nutrients. Meat is pretty nutrient dense, but organs have a lot more minerals in. Bone marrow does, especially as well. So there's other parts that are like more. It's just not as tasty. You got to work with like a liver to make it taste good. You know? So, it's like, fuck, what am I doing with this?
Yeah. Oh, that's
we eat a lot of that crap in England, though. You know, liver and onions, steak and kidney pie. Yeah, we're all about that.
I know.
It's just part of our culture. We still do it. It was always
we did that until MSG made its way over, and they were like, "Wait, it can taste good? Fuck this shit!"
Yeah, but you know, it's almost the same thing. Like, not to say that a bow hunter today has the same reverence and understanding as like a Native American, because they don't.
Sure, like, guaranteed.
It was their culture. It was their life. It was what kept them alive. It was, you know, built into all the beautiful things that they celebrated. But in another way, the hunters today, if you get your animal, I mean, you either butcher it yourself, which is quite a lot of work, especially if it's an elk, because those things are massive, or you'll take it to a butcher that you know or trust or is close to the site where you killed it and is probably well known, and they give you like a price per pound for prepping it. But they do a lot with it, and they give you the option to have the bones, and you can take the organs. And when it's yours, if you have the freezer space, most hunters will keep as much as they can. They
absolutely.
As much as they can use. I mean, the hide gets thrown away because nobody fucking knows what to do with that shit anymore. You're like, all right, we've like lost the skill.
I work in so many reality shows, and one of them was like Last Alaskans, and they would talk about how they'll go hunting and they have a short season, and then they have to cure the meat because that lasts them the year. Like, this is our meat for this gets us through 6 months. And that was like real frontier living. Like, they didn't even like cameras there. I mean, they accepted that they were there because they were documenting what was happening, but that was real frontier living. That's just how it was. Like, there was it wasn't the, you know, crew wasn't feeding them. Crew wasn't giving them, you know, or helping them out or flying in a bag of Doritos or anything. They were simply there to document and to interview them. That was it. It was pretty interesting. And, you know, a lot of these, it was from Inuit tribes. So some of the people weren't anymore. Some were just like white people that were sick of living in a goddamn city. And they were like, fuck it. I'm going to go live in the goddamn wilderness. but it was true. That's how they lived. I mean, it wasn't like a lot of reality is bullshit. But I think when you look more like your documentary, like Discovery Channel and History Channel, things like that, those are more, I wouldn't even call those reality as much as documentary programming. That's real. Like, because they're not manufacturing drama. This is just like, this is what happens in their lives. And they just cut it so it's not incredibly boring. But there's no, it's not like The Bachelor where they're trying to, you know, get the, to lead tribesmen to a fight with an elk or something like that and have him kill the elk for good TV. It's like they hunt to fight. They hunt to eat, and that's it.
Imagine the unique perspective you get if you went and kind of lived like that, even for a month. I mean, you'd realize so fast, holy shit, we are so fragile. Like, getting your own meat is hard as hell. I've gone hunting before. I've done an entire week elk hunting, but it was basically like we hadn't missed the rut. It just hadn't started yet. Like, the temperature was off. It was super hot.
Sure.
And they give you like a set of time, right? So you get like, maybe there's two lots of time for a particular area, and you'll do like the 14th to the 20th, and then the next group will do like the 21st to like the 26th or whatever the times are. And what they try and do is time it for the rut, and the rut is when the elk are breeding. So they're kind of out of their mind. They're just like horny as fuck. It's the one time a year that they breed, and basically it's because they're a little bit sloppy. They're not paying attention.
Sure,
as
they're
much.
Horny.
Because, yeah, they're horny and they're doing their thing. And people are like, well, that's cool when they're horny. Well, look, you can't fucking get them with a bow any other time of year.
Are you kidding me?
And the idea is...
The number of times I've been horny and I was like, just someone kill me. Put me out of my misery. That's the perfect time.
Sometimes it's doing them a favor. But what you do is you find an old, mature bull, elk. That's what you're looking for, male, that's had plenty of seasons of breeding, and it's maybe his last, or maybe he has a couple more. And instead of like slowly just breaking your leg or getting old and getting attacked and eaten by a wolf or some awful way, because everything dies in a horrendous way in nature, I'm afraid to say.
Oh, horrible.
To go like that, just stood up, majestic, and boosh, just done in 1 second. I mean, there's like a beautiful grace to it, in a way. It just is.
Yeah.
But if you miss that window and it's too hot, they all go up into the hills, then you're hiking the whole time. Every shot's basically impossible. You don't even get close. It's a nightmare. It's so difficult. And I remember when I did it that time, I was like, okay, so you can only really get these animals once a year. We have more advanced bows than we would have had 1,000 years ago, of course.
Right.
Now, I don't believe that we're as good at hunting, even the good hunters, and forgive me if you're a hunter and you're listening and you're very good and you think that you'd be better than a hunter 1,000 years ago, you might be right. I don't know. But my guess is when you do it all the time and it's your life and it's the only way you eat, even with shittier equipment, you're really good with it. You're fucking excellent. You know how to track these things. You know how to get on them. But I was like, we didn't get shit. We would have fucking starved to death.
Absolutely.
Like, obviously, we could just reach in our pocket and get little snack bars and Cliff bars. But it's
Postmates.
No joke, man. Yeah, right. Just call it out. They drone. Amazon just drones in a sandwich.
I know. Oh, God. We're so fucked.
Yeah, but it really made me think. I just had not put it together. I was like, well, with modern technology, we should be in abundance. Now, don't get me wrong. If you have a rifle, you're in a lot better position. And it takes slightly less skill, though it's still difficult, and you can be further away, and you could probably get more animals. But, you know, it really gives you a respect for how smart and fast and agile and really just the intelligence of these things. I mean, you don't think of an elk being smart. You're like, well, it must be like a cow. It's going to be pretty dumb. No, it's ahead of you. That's its world.
Oh, I bet it is.
It knows when you're coming. You have to be – there's a lot of luck that goes into it, to be honest.
Oh, I believe that. I believe that for absolute certainty.
Yeah, a ton. And that's why I think, again, it's so important to have someone like Steve Ranella that did the show Meat Eater introduce Joe because of his description to everything. And then Joe be able to come back and like talk about this while basically living in L.A. and being an L.A. comic. I mean, this isn't the type of thing people, you know, are super behind in L.A. They're like, no way. You know, it's a very liberal area, and this is just not a dialogue that is discussed. So it's nice to have a little bit of conversation without people getting really heated. And I'm not saying he's changing a lot of minds, but at least he's just highlighting what it is. And, you know, I appreciate that from a hunter's standpoint. I'm glad that we have people that do that.
Well, you know what? In a world where so many people have their minds made up about a subject, they might not even know about it until it's they're asked about it. I was telling someone the other day, I was like, we live in such an opinionated culture that people have an opinion about something they don't even know about. But if you ask them, they're like, well, this has got to be it, because this is just how my brain feels. And so for someone to actually go out of their way to open up their mind to something that is foreign to them, I actually think it's very mature. And I think it's a good way to look at the world.
It's how we should be speaking. And recently, you know, as you know, Joe has been having these kind of almost like panel discussions, but not really. Like, you have two people right. with kind of opposing ideas, and they talk back and forth. Now, some of those get heated. Some of those have got a little ugly, and there's been some kind of, you know, I think even Rogan is still trying to get the kinks out of it, you know, but he mediates quite nicely. He lets people talk and trying to talk over each other. And it's bringing adult conversations to these very emotional topics. And that's how we've got to do it.
I think so.
It really is. I mean, this is also a good segue to bringing up something you mentioned earlier that we should talk about.
Yeah.
What's her name? Dina Hashem?
Yeah. Hashem? I'd never heard of her. That's not to say she's not good, because I quickly studied up on her and she's very good. But
Know how to say her name. But yeah, this is an example of it. This is an example of people getting very, very upset, taking something out of context, jumping all over someone with threats before they've gone, hold on a minute, this is just a comedian. So
it's
if you want to fill us in for those that don't know, Mark, and then we'll discuss.
Yes. So her name is, here, I wrote it down because I just texted it to you. Dina Hashem. I think it's Dina Hashem. She made a joke about a rapper. I'd never heard of him. I can't even remember his name. Apparently he was fairly popular, fairly famous. Or do we call him a hip-hop artist? I'm going to call him rapper now. I sound like my mom. Is that one of those rap music things? It's hip-hop now, Mom. It's hip-hop. You're hip-hop. So lame.
Cool. Come on.
You know, sadly, he was on his way to buy a car, and he got murdered. And Dina's joke was that, you know, he was on his way.
And he had $50,000
cash. Yeah, he had $50,000 in cash. And he was on his way to buy a car with that cash, and he was murdered, and they took the $50,000. And she said, and you know, and that's actually just a really, you know, that's a really good ad for Venmo. It's like, oh, I don't have Venmo. I should get that. And I read it and I laughed out loud. I was like, that's really clever and funny. And
yeah.
And I will go back to, and I think, and I always go back to Dave Chappelle, because he is everything to me. And he was talking about, it was back in his old, one of his Netflix specials, and he was talking about his the transgender jokes he made. And he was mentioning a letter he received from a transgender fan that said, you know, we're very excited about your show, we're excited to come see it. And then you made this joke and we were devastated. And, you know, and that weighed on him. And then he made this excellent point. He goes, you know, folks, as a policy, I don't feel bad for any of the shit I say up here. And I loved that because, and you sent me a clip of this comic. Well, I can't remember his name, but he was like, that's our job. It's what we do. It's what we do on stage. You make those jokes. You make any joke you can. You got to try them out. You got to get through them.
Yeah. That was Andrew Schultz.
Yes. Schultz.
And big up and comer out of New York, and he's unapologetic and he's funny as fuck.
Yeah, and I'll make a full throated confession. I use comedy to deal with grief. I use comedy to deal with difficult, uncomfortable situations. I've cracked a joke at every close family member's funeral that I have lost, and it wasn't. Now, first of all, I come from a whole line of just tricksters and funny people, so I don't think there would be any problem with them on the other side of the thing, and that was disrespectful. It's how I pay respect, but it's also how I deal with grief. And but at the end of the day, you get to say whatever the fuck you want up there, because somebody's always going to be offended, and then some people are going to goddamn laugh, and that joke's for them.
Yeah, and make it funny. That's the point.
Make it funny.
If you tell a joke like that, where you're just making fun of someone that just got shot or OD'd or whatever, yeah, that sucks, right? That's not cool. But if it's fucking hilarious, then there's therapy in it, right? Well, and obviously, I didn't know that rapper. I wasn't.
Yeah.
I didn't, maybe if he was my best friend, I'd be more bummed. But I'd like to think that I know comedy better than I would know the frustration I would have for that.
And the crux of the joke is don't carry that much cash on you. Like, that's what was so funny, because it was like he was robbed for the cash. So, yeah, I don't know, use Venmo. That's funny. And
it's clever.
And, you know, I was thinking this right before we sat down to do this. Keith Richards will die one day. We might not be there for it, but he will die one day. And there will be a parade, nay, a stampede of comics dropping as many Keith Richards is dead jokes as humanly possible. There might be record set the number of people that will come out of the woodwork to drop Keith Richards is dead jokes. And I can't imagine that there will be that much of a chorus of people upset about it, because he has this whole thing where he's just been destroying his body. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
It's like about time. Like, how did he manage it?
Exactly. And I doubt anyone will be. I'm a huge Rolling Stones fan. I won't be offended. The dude lived forever. Mm. Now, I mean, obviously this gentleman that was, you know, killed probably was gone way too soon. But it just gets back to
and it's
the
an
point.
Awful crime. I mean, no one's not it's saying terrible. That it isn't. Like, of course, it's all fucked up. Like, it's not cool. Somebody got shot. They got killed. But I mean, the fact that this poor girl, who is an excellent comic, is getting death threats
because
she said that is outrageous.
Over a joke.
This
Over
is
a
joke.
Goddamn joke. What would you do? What would you do in a situation where if you got death threats?
Laugh. I'd be so fucking proud. That shit would be all over my Instagram. I'd repost everything.
I'd
do?
Like,
I turn on my
bro.
Tracking. You know how you can turn on your GPS on your phone and your tracking? I would just have like a flashing blue dot and it, I don't know if there's an app, but I'd allow everyone to just know where I am all the time. And I'm like,
come
and shoot me then.
Come at me, bruh.
Yeah, nobody's killing anyone over a joke. You'd be absolutely out of your mind if you even bothered.
100%. Now, unfortunately, there are many people out there who are out of their minds. So,
well, true, but I don't
that
think
is a consideration,
that's not
but
happening.
No. Yeah. That's fucking horrible.
Hit it head on.
And this
so
poor
stupid.
Girl, and you know what sucks? Comedy Central didn't even, like, defend her. They have not released a statement supporting her or anything. It's like, you are Comedy Central. Comedy. Like, you got to back your comedians. You got to back your...
Yeah.
You got to back
They're
them.
Probably... Corporate Central before.
Of course they
Central.
Are. Of course they are. Pussies.
Yeah. It's sad. Right. But I think this is why people need to come together. This is why we need to talk about it right now, and that's why we're choosing to do it. You know?
I also think...
And Joe, I guarantee Joe Rogan will talk about it this week, and they'll go out to millions of people. And they make the point that, hold on a second, like, this is what comedy is. We can't be apologizing for it. It's, you know, I feel like when something like this happens and people push back, all the comics should start writing jokes like this.
I think that's a great
as
idea.
Support. Yeah,
well,
just like
I think
slam
at the end
everyone
of,
with it.
At the end of the day, I love your point that make it funny, because, I mean, if you're gonna go into that controversial area, make it funny. But at the end of the day, you don't get to tell me how to do my art. Whatever you think of comedy, or whatever you think of any other type of art, it is an art form. It is. It's writing, it's performing, and you are naked. Like, it is all you. It is all your work. It is your performance. You don't get to tell me how to do my art. You get to, you know, and you know what? In terms of art, she made some motherfuckers feel some shit. She made some people laugh. She made some people riled up. But that's what art does, and you might not like it.
She made everyone laugh.
She did.
Everyone
because it's
laughed.
A great goddamn joke.
What you do is basically what you're saying is this: you don't let one person in the room tell you how to do your art. It's
Hell
the
no.
room that tells you. So if mostly everyone in a room laughs as a comedian, you know, I've got something here. This is a joke. let's work this. If five people in the room get really butthurt about it, you're like, well, okay, that's how it goes. Now, obviously, don't make it overtly racial or bigotry or like something that's very specific to a religion, because that's lazy and that's bullshit.
It's horribly but lazy. If it's, yeah, and not funny.
It's just stupid. It really isn't. But if you're just crushing with the line like that, you can't let these two or three people, they're going to moan about everything.
Everyone's going to moan.
If they were the audience, if they were the rating system, the judges for all comedy, you wouldn't be allowed to say anything. Nothing would be funny.
Nothing would be funny.
It would be like a Disney cartoon. It'd be horrific.
Horrific. Now, I like the idea that the times have changed, that there are jokes Eddie Murphy did in Delirious and Raw that you just, you don't do anymore, not because it's kind of small-minded, and it just doesn't, it's not the fabric of the world has changed. It's just not really that funny anymore. Because, and my girlfriend puts this best, comedy is about punching up, never punching down. That's why, you know, there's so many comedians that are political, because you're going after the establishment, you're going after government, the aristocracy, the proletariat, the establishment. You're punching up. And I think racial jokes and gay jokes and jokes about, you know, women, misogynistic jokes, I feel like that's punching down. And again, I'm very much of the opinion, no one gets to tell you how to do your art. But at the same time, I think comedy thrives when it's punching up, when it's going after those people that need to be taken down a peg. And this, you know, this girl wasn't going, she wasn't doing any, she wasn't punching down. She made a great joke about Venmo.
Even if it was punching down, if it's a good enough joke, if it's clever,
it's a good enough joke.
Here's the thing. The more offensive it is, the cleverer it needs to be. This is why Andrew Saltz is good. Cause like he'll go after women a little bit, or like women that he's dated. Picking on them for doing things, which some people get upset about. They're like, well, you're a white man and you have already the white male privilege. But
that's his experience.
And he's just poking at different, but he's like bringing them in. He does it in a very clever way. And you can tell there's no hate. There's no, he has no real disrespect. He's just observational. And it's clever. He is a good example of how you do that right. Now, the problem is, it's much easier to do it wrong, and more people would do it wrong. So it makes sense that generally as a whole, you're going to group that whole kind of comedy and say, no, that's out the window, because that's always bad. Well, yeah, of course, of the time it is. But any bad comedy should be thrown out.
Absolutely.
It's the bad comedy portion of it. You're like, you're not
so
funny,
many
and you say sexist
out
shit.
There.
Fuck off.
Oh, I'd rather have you have one like good joke that offends people than 40 shit jokes that no one laughs at, because then you've just wasted my
life. that doesn't and offend anyone.
Boy, we've seen some, haven't we?
Oh my god, yeah.
Woo! You're like, god, just get to the offensive shit and let's get this over with.
Well, you know, and we've told some too. I've told some jokes and I got done with it and I'm like, why did I even say that? That joke sucked. I knew it when I wrote it. I got no laughter. I've just wasted 30 seconds of this set. Because maybe I made it too PC. You know, sometimes I do that. I like scare myself. I'm like, oh, I don't want to put too much controversial stuff. And maybe I'll go easy on this corner. But it just doesn't inspire any emotion. It's like,
That's why I always tell you, be you. Just be you.
Yeah.
But it's true.
Yeah, you have to be. This is what they talk about when comics talk about finding their voice. That's it.
Yep.
That's it.
What do you got to say? Yep. What do you got to say?
Do you think the shows like Jeremiah Watkins' Stand Up on the Spot that Joe Rogan does a lot at the Comedy Store, and for those of you that have never seen that show, if you're in the LA area or you ever go to the Comedy Store, I would really recommend watching Stand Up on the Spot. Now, also, Jeremiah tours with... Jeremiah Watkins tours with Tony Hinchcliffe for the Kill Tony show, and their tours are pretty extensive through the US, so if you're anywhere in another state, check it out when they're coming into town. It's worth hitting up both of those shows. They are fantastic. They really Absolutely. Are. They're very unique and they're unbelievable. But what's really great and what I love about the Stand Up on the Spot show is that, and I talked about it before, is that the audience just shouts out your category. So either you have a story in some stand up, some material that's similar that you can use, or you're just going fresh. And when you go fresh, that's really your voice. Like, this isn't your written voice, yep. your regular, like, comedy voice.
Not your
like
character, Mark, not your
I'm going to say this. You're an excellent writer when it comes to comedy. An excellent writer, right? Thank you're much stronger than I am. You give me a lot of pointers when I do write. But what I'm finding with the show that we do, which is similar to Stand Up on the Spot, but we have to pick the categories from a bucket.
Yeah.
It's called The Challenge, Mike. Where is it? Koreatown? Where is that?
K-Town! Yeah, Koreatown.
Yep, K-Town. It's that you have to... You just create it, right? You're just creating yeah. it on the spot in your voice. And what I'm voice. Finding is I can go back and go, ah, there's something there. And I like Absolutely. The way I structured it because it's more me. Sometimes when I'm writing and then I repeat it, I'm like, this doesn't even sound like me. It's almost like I write in a different way than I'm telling jokes. It's strange. Do you understand?
Well, sure. I mean, I write all my jokes basically just walking around my apartment like it's a challenge mic. Like I'm just coming up and riffing. And usually it's an idea that sparks in my head. I'm like, ooh, this is funny because of this and yada, yada, yada. And then I just, it's kind of like a challenge mic, but there's no audience sitting there waiting for you to laugh at something. So I don't feel the pressure. Gotcha. And that's when my brain just goes nuts. And then I just ask those questions. What, you know, where were you? What did it look like? How did it sound? What was happening? Fill in all those gaps.
That's really excellent advice for anyone that wants to start to get into comedy and to think about it. I mean, I've been doing stand-up now for about 2 years.
Yeah.
And my writing has always been terrible. It stresses me out. It makes me feel like a lazy piece of shit. Sometimes I can sit in front of the computer most of the time and I write nothing.
Sure.
Because I was definitely going about it the wrong way. Like, I needed to have developed that idea on stage, you know, just through one of these kind of mics, and then sat down and crafted it. It's like I had nothing to work with every time I sat down. But there's no fucking rule book for this. It's so difficult
zero
to
rule
get
book.
Your direction.
There's zero rule book, and there's really zero textbook either. Comedy more than any other art form, I feel like, is you're on your own. Figure it out. You're funny or you're not. You've learned it or you're not. You know, which is a shame because, you know, there are no shortage of stand-up comedy classes in the greater Los Angeles area. And most of them are bullshit. But they're not teaching you anything.
Joe talks about that. He never did a class. He kind of finds it funny. And when he talks to other comedians that come on and they've done it, he's like, really? What's that like? What do you do in there? It's almost like he just has no idea. And he literally has a PhD in comedy. I mean, when you think of how long he's done it for and how big areas he sells out, I mean, you know, he knows it as well as people can know things.
Absolutely.
Yet the idea of a class is like, I don't know how that would work. And there's nothing else like this. I don't care what you want to learn. There's a class for it. Not with stand-up. Good luck, baby.
Yeah. I mean, I took a class, and to me, I mean, it was probably arrogant of me, but I went in knowing I would be good at this. I was like, I'm a good comedy writer. I mean, we knew this, and I wanted a safe space to work on my first set. That's what I wanted. And so it was basically, you know, whatever, $300, whatever it was, $350 that I put down, that I had a safe space to go in, workshop some material with a small group of people. And that was valuable to me. I think I got one note from my teacher the whole time. It was like, oh, I don't think that joke works. And I was like, oh, that's good. That's good. And I, you know, I ignored her, and then it didn't work. And I was like, all right, good on you. You knew that. But that was the advantage for me because funny is funny. You know what I mean? I feel like the best a class could help is to help cultivate a set that will probably already be good, but you can make it even stronger. Through just some coaching of like, think about this. What did it look like? How does it sound? Like when comics talk about a conversation they have and then they don't do the voices. I'm like, act out the scene. Show us the scene. Those are tips that you might get in a comedy class that might be valuable. Otherwise, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think there could be something to it. It's just a lot of them, it doesn't work. And it really is more trial by fire. It is. That sort of dynamic. But obviously, you learn it because you do it more. The problem is what you're learning is mostly the learning is when you're on that stage in that 3 minutes.
It's true.
That's it. And the critique is about you doing it again and again and again and finding some jokes and working it. And it's, you know, it's hard to like structure a class around that.
It's true. So
it makes sense.
It's like flying a plane where you know you will crash every time until you don't.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
God.
The best way.
Actually, anytime you give, you try and describe stand up to somebody, especially when you're trying to, like, you're trying to encourage them to do it, it's horrific. Like, everything that you say, you just see it in their face. They're like, why the fuck would I do that? That sounds awful. And you're like, no, it's the best.
But well, you're not
using words that describe that ever.
You and I describe it to our friends. Like when we talk about like the challenge mic or any other type of shows we try out or you know, things like that. And they're always like, what was that like? And I was like, it was terrifying and horrible. I can't wait to do it again. Yeah. And they're like, and you see on their face, like, I'm never doing that. But, you know, I don't blame them because I was much older until I had the guts to do it because that shit's scary. Plus, I had nothing to say when I was younger. I had nothing interesting to say about the world.
Yeah, well, that's something that Rogan talks about when he has, you know, he often does when he has his older friend comics on that he's known for like 20 years, like Greg Fitzsimmons and Tom Papa and Brian Callen. And I think even Tom Segura, he's known a very long time. But, you know, they talk about how they just didn't know shit when they were like 20 something years old.
So
the depth of their stories, it's so much harder to do it. So in a way, yeah, we got into it later. So we got a lot of work to do, but it's you are coming in with more tools once you relax. You know, you
Absolutely.
May not have the stage time experience, but you can really pull from those stories. And then we're so lucky being in the LA area that we get to go to the Comedy Store and you can watch the killers, the best of the best. You
know, exactly.
People like Rogan just crafting his set. That's one of the most beautiful things you get to see. If you know that they just filmed their special, and with Joe, that's easy because he talks about it a lot on his podcast, then you'll go to the Comedy Store, and then he's like building it after that. You've paid 10, 20 bucks. Yeah, you get to see like a kind of more nervous, a kind of less structured set coming out of somebody who's very, very good. And then over the months that you watch him, you know, like I'll probably in a year, I'll watch his like actual set other than going to the stand up on the spot show, which is obviously basically the improv version of his comedy. I'll probably watch him 4 or 5 times.
Okay.
And that'd be from the beginning, just because he'd be on a lineup I want to see. I'm usually going to watch maybe someone that is coming in from out of town. You know, maybe Bill Burr's here, maybe Andrew Schultz is here, maybe Ari Shafir is in town. It's usually someone that I don't get to see very often, but then Joe is on the lineup, or Theo Vaughn is on the lineup, or Chris D'Elia is on the lineup anyway, and you get to see those. You get to see those sets developing. You're like, oh, I remember that joke from last time. Wow, he's really changed a lot of elements. It's cool to see them work. It's so fascinating.
Absolutely,
you know, that's their playground. I love it. And on that note, this special edition of the Joe Rogan Experience, where we just talked about hunting and comedy. Until Joe gets back, he should be throwing some podcasts out this week. We'll see. Where are you performing this week, Mark? Those of you in the LA area that like some comedy, if you get out Friday and Saturday, where are you going to be?
Yeah, Friday, 7 o'clock, Original Room Comedy Store, part of the one of the up and coming comics and the D's Nuts show. At the Copper Still on Saturday, 8 p.m., Missouri something. I don't remember the name of the show. But it's 8 o'clock at the Copper Still in K-Town.
Nice. And the Copper Still's a cute little place. It's a
cool
place to know and swing by. That's also where we do the challenge mic on the Wednesdays. It's just like, it's a fun little area. It's a nice little back room.
But don't have Pinot Grigio. They just have Chardonnay. And they'll ask you if that's okay. And it's all right if you say no, like I did. It's like, no, God, no. Why would you offer that?
No. Just like, all right, we're at Rosé then, bro.
Right. We don't have Pinot Grigio, but we have urine. Oh, okay, sure, I'll take that.
Yeah, we have this bucket of eyeballs. We're like, is it fermented? Exactly. Yeah. Nah, still don't want it. Yeah, exactly. Wild times. But anyway, always, guys, thank you guys for listening. Get out and watch some comedy. Find it in your local area. It doesn't matter who's there. Go support it. Watch it. It's the best 10 or 20 bucks you can spend. I promise you, it'll cheer you up. And that's it. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.